The census numbers are now in. Now comes the once every 10 years job of redrawing congressional and state legislative districts. Much has happened since Pennsylvania lawmakers, who still draw the lines, did this a decade ago. Perhaps the most significant was the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling that boundaries drawn the last time were gerrymandered to favor Republican candidates. Republicans were and are in the majority in the legislature. The court ordered the map to be redrawn, and when agreement couldn't be reached, the court adopted its own map. A bipartisan committee is working on legislative districts. The congressional lines could be more of a challenge. A number of groups have called for reforms and transparency, and two of them are with us today. David Thornburg is president and CEO of the Committee of 70, and Carol Cunaholm is chair of Fair Districts PA. I want to thank both of you for being with us today, and I'll ask this question of both of you. Your organizations have made redistricting a priority for better government. What are your thoughts on the process, on how it's gone so far this time, or is it too soon to tell? David Thornburg, let me start with you.
Thanks, Scott. This has been a big priority for us for good reason. There's a lot of power in the ability to draw those maps. We're now in the ninth inning. We have 76 days left to draw congressional maps and legislative maps so that we don't disrupt the primaries and cause chaos and confusion next spring. I think the best news about what's happened so far is that there are thousands, if not millions, of eyes and ears on this process. Carol's group has been terrific. We've been active through our Draw the Lines project. There's a group called Represent Us that has been active recently. So people are watching this process like never before, and they have the tools to do that because the software and the data are available like never before. So we're watching very, very closely.
Mm-hmm. Carol Cunaholm, your thoughts on what's happened so far?
Well, there's certainly been far more attention, as David said. There's been far more interest, far better tools, and there are some guidelines and guardrails in place that were not there because of the Supreme Court case, more precedent, and certainly more checks and balances. The governor can veto a map. The last time around, the governor was the same party as those drawing the lines, and We're watching. We're confident that it will be better. How much better? We're not sure, but we're certainly watching the process play out.
And let me tell our audience that if you have a question or comment about redistricting, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are @smarttalkwitf. Once again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Carol, this is not what you wanted. I mean, you ultimately, and I'm going to ask you what you ultimately wanted, but you did want an independent commission to redraw the maps. But in your mind, through this process, what has changed for the better?
Well, what has changed for the better is far more public attention and far better tools. As David mentioned, people can draw their own maps. They can share maps quickly. I mean, even Zoom allows us to share a map, get on a video, talk about maps. We've had public forums with over, 300 or 400 or 500 people across the state who are able to jump together to look at maps together closely, look at metrics. And the metrics are huge. A decade ago, there were not many ways to evaluate a map to see, is it compact? Does it meet requirements for contiguity and minimizing splits to counties and municipalities? Now you can have those metrics in minutes. And so there's plenty of tools that allow the public to look at them. And fortunately, the Legislative Reapportionment Commission with Chair Mark Nordenberg have made use of those tools. They're inviting map submission through use of those tools, and they have put the data on those tools, provided the data quickly to those particular apps. And I believe their plan is, I'm hoping, we will be asking for them to share their maps in a way that the public can evaluate really quickly. We're not so sure that the state government committees are doing that. They just opened a portal this week allowing submission of maps, but it's not in a user-friendly way. It's not the apps that the public has been using. We would like them to do that because there's much more transparency and it's much easier for the public to see does this map meet requirements or does it simply not?
And just to point out to everyone who's listening, because there are a lot of people involved in this process, but yet there aren't. I know that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but we can talk about it. But that reapportionment commission you talked about, their task is to come up with the state legislative boundaries, state representatives and state Senate boundaries. So, David, I ask about what Carol liked about this time. What don't you like about what's going on right now?
Well, right now, this is all about the maps. And we're getting increasingly frustrated that we haven't seen draft maps, either congressional maps or legislative maps. And there have been broad commitments to transparency and accountability. But right now, unless and until citizens can see a map, can react to that, can comment on it, can help improve it, that sense of transparency is transparent. In the meanwhile, by the way, and sort of picking up on Carol's point, you know, over the last 3.5 years, we've enlisted 7,211 citizens to actually draw their own congressional maps. And we've used that sort of their collective wisdom to draft what we're calling a citizen's map, and have shared that with the legislature. We were up in Harrisburg a couple weeks ago, handing out puzzles of that map to all of the legislators. It's a decent, solid map, and it should be taken seriously, perhaps most particularly because we haven't seen anything yet from the legislature. So the clock is ticking, and we need to see a map.
When you say a decent, solid map, what is a decent, solid map?
Well, first of all, it's been vetted by 7,211 people. So this wasn't someone in a, you know, there some dark room somewhere just conjuring up a diabolical map that serves some partisan interest. The second is, Carol mentioned, you know, the metrics, the way to evaluate maps are publicly available. We've vetted this with lots of folks. It's not perfect, but the whole point of this is to post up a draft map, get comments, improve it again, and until everyone's as satisfied as they could be. That's what I say when we feel like this is a solid map and a good starting point.
Let's take a phone call from Faith in Lancaster Township. Faith, you're on Smart Talk.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is this. What legal guidelines, if any, determine what a map should look like? I've seen these online things that say draw your own map, but I have no idea, you know, what a good map, good meaning legal and objective, should look like. And I'll hang up then.
Well,
thank you.
Faith, you may have the ultimate question there. David, I'll start with you. I mean, I know I say this every time that we talk, but this is an issue that just a few years ago, not many people paid attention to. It has become a major issue, not just in Pennsylvania, but across the country, and many people are paying attention to it. But the point that and the question that Faith asked, how is the public to know how to draw a map that is legal, meets requirements, and is fair?
Well, there's really only a few guidelines, particularly for the congressional map, that you have to follow. Most notably, that the population of the districts needs to be as close to even as practically possible. But the map drawing process, when it's done well, reflects people's sense of community, of their districts, that reflects the geography of the state. You know, you can't draw two districts that are on either side of a mountain or either side of a river. So really, at the end of the day, what steps forward as a fair map is one that's a product of a fair, open, and transparent process where there's an exchange of ideas and then a compromise. Any map that we step forward with, which is a good map, should be a product of compromise and brought on by a rich conversation. So, and you know, to Faith's point, and to Carol's point, the technology is available in a way that has never been before. We've had mappers who, you know, you can do a congressional map in maybe a half an hour. You have to think about it hard to what you're going to produce, but the barriers to actually drawing maps are now pretty low.
Carol, but there are some challenges along the way. I mean, this is not an easy process. I mean, if I had to choose, I'd choose a congressional map because there's only in the teens as far as districts you have to come up with. But, you know, one of the things that the census has shown us is that, for example, with demographics, people of the same demographic tend to be packed into areas. Democrats tend to be packed into urban areas. Republicans nowadays are in rural areas. Suburbs, kind of after last Tuesday, I don't quite know. But, you know, the point I'm making is that if you go strictly by geography, that you could have all Democrats packed into an area and a much larger area for Republicans geographically. How do you overcome that?
Well, we are just, you're right that drawing a congressional map is certainly easier. It's 17 districts this time, and that's what Draw the Lines and Committee of 70 focused on drawing a citizen map for that. We've been just completing people's maps for the House and Senate, which is 253 districts, much more work. And we are just finalizing that, and we'll be making it public tomorrow. We made it available 2 weeks ago for public comment. And there are requirements for state House and Senate that they be compact, that they be contiguous, that they split as few counties, municipalities, and wards as possible. But then there's also requirements that maps allow people to have some say in the election. That was part of the League lawsuit, that, you know, free and equal elections mean that your votes actually do count in some way. And there's also requirements about minority representation, that minority groups need to be recognized, and maps need to be drawn in a way that can maximize minority representation. Pennsylvania is pretty far behind on that. So our mapping process involved kind of balancing all of those requirements carefully, and then inviting a lot of feedback from people who live in specific areas to say, does this look like it works for you? But it has to work for locations, it has to work for communities, it has to work for counties, but it has to work for the state as a whole. And your point about, yes, there are districts that are 95% Republican, there are really very few that are more than 95% Democratic, because Democrats do tend to pack very tightly into urban areas. Republicans are spread out, but there's also there are others mixed into those. So you never get above about a 75 or 80% Republican. So you've got to be really thoughtful about how to draw the lines so that the outcome is not biased in one direction. It's a challenge.
And we'll talk more about that in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're discussing redistricting, and we're in the midst of that right now. At least we think we are. As far as transparency goes, that's another story. But we're talking with David Thornburgh, President and CEO of Committee of 70, and Carol Kuhnholm, Chair of Fair Districts PA. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we're at smarttalkwitf. Let's take a phone call from Mike in York. Mike, you're on Smart Talk.
Good morning to all of you, and thank you for having this subject on. I think part of the question I was going to ask was answered in the transition, as Carol mentioned, that they developed maps for the legislative districts, because part of it was I was going to ask you to go back to basics for each of your organizations as to how you're focusing on congressional districts versus the state legislative districts. But I guess the other part to it is, as you know, we have a pretty conflictual political situation in PA as well as in the country. And, you know, as to making final decisions, you know, we're trying to create a an inclusive process to involve a lot of people with maps and discussions. But bottom line is there's going to be some crunch time. And where do you both see that, you know, happening? And what maybe can the public do to influence that?
Hey, Mike, thank you very much for your call. David Thornburg, this is that crunch time, as Mike referred to it, as where the problem has always existed with coming up with fair, solid districts, as you have described them. How do you do that?
Crunch time is 76 days from today. January 24th, the Department of State said that's when we need maps to put in front of candidates who need to file for election or re-election, and to voters who need to know, you know, who they're voting for where. So 76 days from now, we need those maps. And I think, as I said earlier, the call now is to see a draft map. Citizens need time to react to a potential map. And by the way, we have the holidays coming up. So folks are going to be distracted, as they should be. So let's get on with it. Let's put out a congressional map. Let's put out state, House, and Senate maps, and give folks a chance to kick the tires and tell legislators what they like and they don't like. And anything short of that is really not accountable or transparent. So that's where we are and what we need to do. I'll point out, by the way, there are only about 18 states now of the 50 that haven't yet at least produced a draft map on the congressional process. So, you know, the clock is ticking and we're not standing tall as we should be.
David, I hate to say it, but I was anticipating you say the holidays are coming and you were going to suggest that people look over maps over Thanksgiving dinner.
Well, we will in my house.
I kind of thought that was...
I can't speak for the rest of Pennsylvania.
But what the Thornburgs will be doing on Thanksgiving dinner.
They have a great time.
It sounds that way. But, Carol, Mike's bigger point. What input can the public have even once they have seen these maps? I mean, do voters contact their legislators and say, hey, listen, I don't like that map. I don't think it's fair. Or I love that map. This is what I want to see.
Yeah, so I would say a really important thing to do is go to our website, fairdistrictspa.com, and hit the join button and make sure you're on our email list, because we will be sharing information, and we constantly are sharing information about hearings, sharing links. And if you look on our website, you can find links to give testimony right now. And once the Legislative Reapportionment Commission makes their maps available, by law, they have to allow 30 days for public feedback. As soon as those maps are available, we'll be sharing links to those, we'll be sharing information, we'll be sharing how to give feedback, and we'll be having our own Zoom forums that we can look at, probably regional forums, to look at those maps regionally so people can understand what the maps are, understand what they do, and prepare their own comment and feedback. So it's really important just to get the latest information, and you can find that at fairdistrictspa.com. I would say for the Legislative Reapportionment Commission, there will be 30 days, and they have said they will have maps available by the end of November. We're hoping they have them by Thanksgiving, because if they do, that allows 30 days, and then they can be finalized before the holiday break. If they don't, they're going to be spending their holiday break dealing with feedback and finalizing maps. So they would be wise to get those maps ready and to the public by Thanksgiving. That's the Legislative Reapportionment Commission. On the other side, the congressional map, we are not impressed with the way the state government committees have failed to really. The House State Government Committee has had hearings, but they've been during the day when working people are at work in places that are hard to get to, not accessible by Zoom. There's not been a lot that has said we're going to do a really fair and transparent process, but we do know that the governor can veto a map that does not meet standards. And he signaled that he would do that by appointing a six-person redistricting advisory council. That council has had listening sessions. They're going to have a virtual listening session on Monday. So people who have not been able to be part of local, regional, listening sessions can show up and say, this is what we're looking for when you map our region for congressional maps. So that council will be a part of the governor's check and balance on the process, which is really valuable. So folks can reach out to the council. They have there are many web portals at the moment. You can offer feedback to the governor's redistricting council. You can offer feedback to both state government committees. You can offer feedback to the Legislative Reapportionment Commission, and they all have portals. House State Government Committee just announced a portal where you can submit maps. So there's lots of ways to engage. Where that land, we're not sure, but it's really important to keep focused on it as this unfolds.
David, I'm going to ask you this question from Tim in Marietta. Why is it important to the average Pennsylvanian that we have a fair map? What improvements do you hope to see if we can limit or even eliminate gerrymandering?
That is an incredibly important question. That's really what motivated the start of Fair Districts PA back in January 2016. One of the things that happens with the fair map is you can hold legislators accountable. When they have districts drawn to protect incumbents, which we've seen for 40 years now, they get more and more settled and safe in their districts. They get pushed to the partisan extremes because the only election that counts is the primary. And we have less and less responsiveness in our state legislature. If we have a responsive elections, if we have districts that really represent us well, we can hold legislators accountable. And there's a long, long list of things that Pennsylvanians have been asking for decades. Property tax reform, school funding equity, merit selection of judges. There are many things that a majority of Pennsylvanians want to see happen, and they don't happen because the legislators don't have to do it because of our distorted districts. So this has huge implications for us for the next decade, and getting it right will make a big change in Pennsylvania politics and policy.
David,
Scott, I'll underline what Carol said and maybe just add a couple more thoughts. This is really about, in a very basic sense, about how well the people of Pennsylvania are represented. And as I said at the outset, there's an enormous power in being able to draw these lines. When you have a choice of either you can carve up a community and literally put one side of the street in one district and another side on the other side. And in doing that, make it very difficult for people to raise their voice to tell you what they want. They're confused about who represents them. They'd understand all the twists and turns on the map. And it's one more signal that their legislators are not really paying attention to them and they can do whatever they want. So this is, in a very real sense, an opportunity for citizens to take back the process. And I think, as Carol said, that's what we've been after the last few years with our Draw the Lines project. And, we remain hopeful that legislators recognize the opportunity to stand tall and fulfill their promise to deliver a transparent and accountable process. But as I said before, the clock's ticking.
David, here are a couple cynical questions. And let's face it, in this atmosphere we're in now, there are some cynics out there. What's to say that elected representatives are going to listen to the people anyway? That's one thing. And the other cynical part of that question is, or maybe a statement, is that legislators are always going to do what they can to protect their own self-interest. Now, for some, that's the reality, those two things. How do you respond to that?
You know, both the House and Senate leadership have gone to great lengths early on to say this time's going to be different. There was a group of House leadership in June that got together and said, this is going to be the most transparent and accountable process in the history of redistricting. So we have to keep them, take them at their word, but hold them accountable to those words. They can't just be empty words. They've got to demonstrate that they take this seriously. At the end of the day, as in most aspects of our democracy, what we have is the voice of the people. And between Carol's group and our group and others, I would say there are 50, 60, 75, maybe 100,000 people around the Commonwealth who have gotten involved and gotten engaged and learned about this process. And they're not going to go away if this is in fact, kidnapped and hijacked as it has in the past. We expect more from our legislative leadership this time around. And then people will do what they can to express their disappointment, if that's the case, at the ballot box. That's all we have.
Let me just follow up on that a little bit. A recent Franklin and Marshall College poll, when Pennsylvanians were asked the biggest problem that the state faces, the issue that was most important to them, the number one answer was government. Now, you know, we always have had a little bit of an issue with determining what that means when voters say that government is the number one issue or the biggest problem that is facing Pennsylvania. But is this something I noticed when I looked down to the list of issues that redistricting, gerrymandering was not amongst the top issues for Pennsylvanians. When they say government, does that mean is gerrymandering or is redistricting part of what Pennsylvanians see as the problem?
I would say that what people are saying is they feel like they are not being listened to. So that when 70% of Pennsylvanians say, we want a bill that does this, and that bill is never given a vote, less than 7% of bills introduced in Harrisburg ever pass. 3/4 never even get a vote in committee. And that's things like lead exposure, ameliorating lead exposure for kids in housing or public schools. Minimum wage, we've never had a vote on that since the minimum wage was passed. There's a long, long list of things that people say, could you just give it a vote? You know, whatever the vote is okay, but give it a vote. And there are so many issues that Pennsylvanians just feel like, what are you doing in Harrisburg when we ask you over and over and over again to give this particular, the pre-canvassing of ballots, mail-in ballots, county commissioners, a really heartbreaking quote was, a county commissioner said, we learned long ago not to expect anything from Harrisburg. When a Republican county commissioner says that about their Republican legislature, something is really badly broken. And I think that's what that is. But gerrymandering is a way to address that. Fixing gerrymandering, having fair districts is a way to get at that. And many people don't understand that. But if we had better districts, we would have a more responsive legislature. We could move towards better rules in the way the legislature functions, and we could actually get some of those things addressed that we've been asking for decades. I think that's what people are talking about.
David, you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I think this is very much wrapped into people's response on the poll that you mentioned. There is just a frustration that their representatives are out of touch, not paying attention, doing things in their own interest and not in the interests of their constituents. So there's a lack of trust. And, you know, once you dig into this issue, you can see how powerful the redistricting pen is and why it's so important that this time around, we not repeat the travesties of the past. And we have a chance to do that. We still have time for legislators to step forward, show us a map, get some honest feedback, put that in the hopper and come back with something better. And I think if they do, that will in some small measure push back against this mistrust that you've cited. People are pretty smart at differentiating between talk and action. And now it's time for action.
Mike has a really big point this year when we're talking about congressional redistricting. Pennsylvania is going to have one less congressional representative and district this year. How important is that? How do you think that will be handled? And when I say, how do you think it will be handled? Again, we haven't heard very much about the congressional districts and how they're being drawn so far. David, let me address that to you. What does this one fewer congressional district mean for redistricting?
Well, it's huge. And I'll make sort of an obvious point that one of the reasons that this deadline of January 24th is so important is that you can't just reuse the same districts one more time for the congressional maps, because we're going from 18 seats to 17 seats. So doing that is not an option. That January 24th is a deadline by which we have those seats. Now, of course, anytime, you know, there's one fewer chair, one less chair in the musical chairs game, things get interesting because all kinds of political intrigue and shifting interests and, you know, trying to catch up with population trends all come into play. So it does make the job easier or more difficult, sorry. But it's also, we've been doing this since the 30s. Every decade, Pennsylvania has lost congressional seats. So you'd think we'd be getting better at it. But there's no question it complicates things, but makes it all that more important that we have time to consider what 17 districts look like rather than 18. And by the way, I'll say our citizens map, which we released right after Labor Day, incorporates 17 districts. So this is possible. But now it's time to actually post up the maps.
Let's take a phone call from Patrick in Mount Joy. Patrick, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you for this important discussion. In my conversations with friends over these years, you know, everybody always wants term limits for politicians. I think this is a good idea. Well, there's no real point to a term limit if the people keep on getting elected and reelected and reelected. And, you know, this apportionment business is part and parcel of that. You know, it's almost a kissing cousin to this issue. How do you get rid of your congressman if they always get elected because of redistricting? But yet, at the same time, you say you want term limits.
There are a lot of related issues. Kissing cousins. I never heard that analogy, but I may use it, Patrick, in the future. Carol, what do you think about what Patrick had to say?
Well, there are kissing cousins. People bring up term limits. My sense from getting to know what happens in Harrisburg, if there were term limits, then the people who would really control things are the partisan staff and the lobbyists, because it takes a while to really understand how things work and to get enough experience to be effective in Harrisburg. If we had elections where you could vote out people who promised things and then didn't deliver, if we had elections where, you know, you really could have a say, term limits would be off the table. It wouldn't be important. And I do think term limits is not a good idea. But there are other issues like open primaries. That's something that both David and I feel strongly about. Open primaries would remove the partisan control of our electoral process and allow independents a greater say and allow a larger, more expansive opportunity to really hear ideas instead of just voting for the partisan choice. So it would remove some of the partisan tone. And election campaign finance reform is another really important one. There's a lot of money that flows into Pennsylvania elections. The public doesn't see it, but that controls a lot of the outcomes. So I would say open primaries, campaign finance are the kissing cousins that I think would be far more effective than term limits. And those are certainly on our radar to work toward in the future.
Here's a question from Lee. It says, how does one do redistricting in urban areas which have a high percentage of African Americans without diluting their voting power by creating a small number of predominantly black districts? David, how about that?
Sure. I mean, that is the spirit that powers the Voting Rights Act from the mid-60s. And it's really important. And you put you use the words that are in that act. You can't dilute the power of particularly African-American voters and other minority voters by dispersing them across districts. That having said, if you put all of those voters in one district, if you pack them into one district, you're also diluting their power because that's the only district in which they have some impact. So it comes down to the numbers, but you know, you can think of a way in which, let's say, African-American voters maybe represent 30% of the voters in one district, 30% in another district, 30% in another district, where they would continue to have considerable political power, in fact, spread over three districts, as opposed to all packed into one district. So, you know, there's art in this, but I'll just go back to the song I've been singing, which is that all of this becomes much more manageable if there's a robust conversation between the voters and the people they vote for. And that's how we work this out. That's how we ought to work this out. In the light of day, back and forth and arrive at some set of compromise. And I'm, as I said, I'm still hopeful that we can do that between now and January 24th, but time is short.
Carol, David is hopeful. Well, both of you have sounded somewhat hopeful during this conversation. As I mentioned in the introduction, a few years ago, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that the last time there was redistricting, that there was gerrymandering and the districts were unconstitutional. Are we at a stage where we can speculate on whether anything that is drawn up will have to go to the Supreme Court again, and the possibility of the Supreme Court making decisions on what map is constitutional and which maps aren't? I say that there was another state, I'm trying to remember which one, you probably know, where even with an independent commission, that state Supreme Court is being asked to decide on maps.
There's a great deal of litigation surrounding maps. I know that those who are drawing our maps, both in the state government committees and the Legislative Reapportionment Commission, want to draw maps that do not go to the Supreme Court. There will likely be litigation surrounding the reallocation of prison data. I'm sure there are folks conjuring up lawsuits as we speak, but I believe that the goal is to draw maps that the courts would say were sound, were fair, and can stand. And so I think that's a great incentive right now. Nobody really wants to have the courts appointing a special master to draw the maps again. And I think that's a really good incentive for a much better process. And as David has said, to keep the light of day, sunlight is a great disinfectant. The more people pay attention, the more people speak up, the more the Voting Rights Act question is an important one, that there are minority communities who are far more engaged this time around than in the past, who are looking closely to say, where are we underrepresented? What would it take to be represented better? All of those conversations are taking place, and those who are drawing the maps know that. So that is a really important piece of this conversation. So I'm hopeful that we will see much better maps. But as David said, we'd like to see them soon so we have a chance to respond to them and not have them pushed through at the very last minute, as happened in the past.
Yeah, the last time, 10 days. This was all wrapped up in 10 days where decisions were made. Carol Cunaholm, yeah. Chair of Fair Districts Pennsylvania. David Thornburg, President and CEO, Committee of 70. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lear.
The Biden administration implemented a vaccine mandate in September that would require any business or employer with at least 100 employees to require vaccinations or weekly COVID-19 testing. That requirement, which impacts more than 80 million workers in the private sector, was halted this weekend by a federal appeals court, although the White House has told employers to move ahead with it. With all the legal maneuvering and political posturing taking place, and one important question remains, how effective are mandates for changing or impacting behavior? A recent University of Pennsylvania study researched this very issue. Joining us is Dr. Dolores Albersin, who is a social psychologist and lead study author at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Albersin, thank you very much for being with us today. Do vaccine mandates work? Do more people get vaccinated when they are required to in order to keep their jobs or not be tested?
That's a great question. We have two pieces of evidence on this point. First, we can look at what's happening in New York City, for instance. And in addition, we have our experimental evidence that we published in this study. And what we did is we went on and decided to look at the possible effects of mandates earlier during the pandemic. And that was actually, we began in January, all the way through April. So we conducted several experiments trying to determine what should we do? Should we make the vaccine mandatory? Should we allow people to simply choose what to do based on a recommendation that it's a good idea, but it's up to you? Or should we be telling people that the vaccine will actually make them feel freer? And we actually tested this over four different studies. In the first one, we went ahead and asked people two questions. If the COVID-19 vaccine were to be mandatory in order to work, go to school, hop on a plane, would you get it? And the other question is, would you get the vaccine freely if offered to you today? And we did this in different racial and ethnic groups because at that point it was well known that there could be more hesitancy in some racial groups. What we found was the same for all participants, for white participants, Hispanic and Black participants across all groups. The question about a required vaccine elicited a lot more, a lot stronger intentions to vaccinate. So across the board, 86% said they would vaccinate if required versus 68% if, you know, optional.
So bottom line is vaccine mandates work for the most part if you go by those percentages.
By these percentages, they do. And if you look at the results in New York City, right, they have increased vaccination rates in similar percentages, sometimes exactly 20%. And then we went on and tested several other possibilities because, of course, there are main fear for psychologists and also for policymakers. But from the psychological point of view, we know that there are certain mandates that can sometimes elicit what's called psychological reactance, which is this tendency to do exactly the opposite of what you're told. So we had this fear that perhaps, you know, a mandate or strong requirement could be eliciting that sort of reaction among our participants. So this sort of oppositional defiance to the mandates. But we did not find that. We had other studies in which we gave them vignettes. You are going into a new job situation and there is a new disease and they either, you know, different conditions would stage while the vaccine is required or the employer recommends it, but it's up to you. For the vaccine, it's likely to make you feel freer, having more options of things to do, and you know the softer approach. And again, we found then the requirement led to stronger intentions. When we also manipulated how popular the vaccine was, we found the same thing. So even when we told them that the vaccine was unpopular in the population within the job setting, still the requirement produced stronger intentions to vaccinate. And supplementary analysis show that even among the more conservative participants ideologically, the mandates elicited stronger intentions to vaccinate.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the reasons that I think that your research is so valuable. It's because most of the polls, and I won't call it research, most of the polls that have been taken over the last 19 months, or, well, you can't say that because the vaccine only came out 11 months ago, but over the last 11 months or so, have focused on politics and the political divide rather than psychological. So do you, you said something that I found very interesting, that even when you've factored in politics, that if there was a mandate that politics didn't make that much of a difference, that people would be more likely to get vaccinated.
Exactly. And this was, you know, January through April. So what we need to do at this point is retest to see what happens. Because once you politicize it, and now this becomes a weapon, right? Mandates become a political weapon, then you could be swaying the public opinion, and you know that could change things. But what we know is that in their natural state, right, in January, April, even conservatives had stronger intentions to vaccinate if mandated.
If you're just tuning in and you have a question or comment for our guest, Dr. Dolores Alva-Racine, who's a social psychologist and lead study author at the University of Pennsylvania looking at vaccine mandates, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Dr. Alva-Racine, employers were concerned that they would lose employees to competitors if they required mandates. Did you look at that at all in your research, and what did you find?
We did not, but I mean, we did control for employment status. We did not look at that, but generally the mandates have not led to, you know, very large, you know, desertions in the workplace. That's the general data that I'm aware of, but we did not focus on that specifically.
Looking
at a concern, but of course employers have been concerned about this, you know, independent of mandates, right?
So
given the many changes in jobs and other difficulties. Yeah.
Looking at psychology and personality types, there have been some, even though not a large percentage. But for example, when the city of New York required workers, I think I saw a percentage of like 5%. It was in the single digits of people who quit rather than getting the vaccine. What kind of personality type is that would give up their living, how they support themselves and their family rather than getting the vaccination?
Yes, well, I'm not exactly sure of who these individuals are, but I could speculate. I mean, some I know are people who are very close to retirement, and then they went that way. And, you know, it is possible, yes, that people change jobs, and these would be individuals who would be highly reactant, so truly oppositional. And, you know, it's somewhat ironic that this would be within the police force, but because it would be, you know, on the one hand, you could imagine that would be the population that would be most likely to follow laws, right? And these mandates are safety laws, very much like not running a red light or not running through a stop sign. But it would be individuals who do not dislike deeply being controlled, and then they would oppose it. But within our studies, we did measure psychological reactance as a trait. That is, those same individuals who tend to want to do, you know, the opposite of what they are told. And even among those, the requirements were still more effective in strengthening intentions.
You know, I have to smile because it almost sounds like cliche. When parents are disciplining their children, sometimes they'll say, "You'll just do the opposite of what I say." So that really is, there is a personality type that actually will do the opposite of what they are told to do.
Right. And it is possible that, you know, within certain sectors of government, you can imagine that they are used to being in control more than being controlled. Hmm. But these are no different from seatbelt laws.
We only have a minute or so left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. The Biden administration vaccination mandate for employers, you know, that the federal court did strike down over the weekend, but the administration is going to continue ahead with it. Seems like it makes it even more political. As you have said, the vaccine mandates work. But if people view it as more political, like this Democratic president said, we have to do this, does that mean there may be more people who will object to it? I only have about a minute left.
This could very well be the case, and it's one of the dangers of continuing to politicize the pandemic. These are our health issues, and we do need high compliance rates, high adherence to the vaccine at this juncture. No questions. But of course, if we politicize it and we take it to court, there is a risk of further polarizing the situation and essentially, putting many, many lives at risk.
Hmm. Dr. Dolores Alba-Racin is a social psychologist and the lead study author of this study, this research on vaccination mandates at the University of Pennsylvania. Doctor, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.